You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello there, I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and this is one of my favourite interviews conducted in New Zealand at the International Comedy Festival there last month. Michelle Acourt is a provocative, challenging, very astute, and most importantly, very funny comedian who I met at World Buskers in Christchurch earlier this year and got to talk to in Auckland a few weeks ago. So with no further ado, here she is, Michelle Acourt. Thank you, Michelle Acourt, for coming and appearing on the show. And I was thinking, what was the first thing I wanted to ask you? And in all honesty, I wanted to go, so, are women funny? Simply because you wrote the best kind of riposte, the best comprehensive answer to that question. And I hope you don't mind, we can talk about it at some point or not. But obviously the point of what you wrote is, never ask me this question again. Here's everything you could possibly know.
I quite like to, in mainstream media, say if you ask me any of those questions, there are two possible things that will happen. The first is I will pull out my copy of what I wrote and hand it to you, and you can read the answers yourself. Or that the only alternative answer I will give is to say cunt flats. And if they know that going in, and I end up saying that on television or on national radio or commercial radio or something, well, terrific. It's their fault.
So you, just for people who haven't read the thing, I won't try and praise you the whole thing. We can direct them. It's on your blog, the address of which is...
MichelleAcourt.com.
Okay.
With no punctuation in it.
Sure. And the answer was, you've been a comedian for how long?
21 years now.
21 years.
Yeah.
And in that time, you must have fielded the Are Women Funny debate, left, right, centre.
And over again. I mean, I wrote that piece because I had just been interviewed the day before about it. And, by a perfectly lovely person. It's not like anybody's being an asshole. But so I'd done that interview and I felt myself giving the same answers again. And I'd been asked to do it... excuse me, a month before as well. And, so this was March, so I had answered it. I think I had done three interviews by then, and it happens six times a year. And you multiply that by 21, and I'm just over it.
Mm-hmm.
And I also bore the shit out of myself with those answers too, because I've heard them. And so I was going to stay at home and watch a whole lot of, crap programs on My Sky one night. And I thought, no, I'm so angry. So I opened a bottle of wine and wrote that.
That's an amazing intro. I opened a bottle of wine and got stuck in.
Yeah.
And the reason I feel like I should bring it up even, and obviously I'm not going to sit here and ask you whether you think women are funny, but your show that I saw, we met in Christchurch. I didn't know. We met in Christchurch earlier this year at the World Buskers Festival, and you did a show there called Things I Forgot to Tell My Daughter.
Yeah.
And a big portion of that show was personal stuff about your child, or now grown-up child.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was observational comedy about motherhood and childhood and parenthood. And also at the end, there was a substantial section about feminism.
Yes.
Which I thought was brilliant because it took the stance of being an actual... You weren't afraid to kind of... I don't want to say lecture, but you were educating. You weren't afraid to educate.
Yeah, yeah. That was a conscious thing that I thought about doing because I'm in my 50s now, and you get to a point where you, Lena Cohen says, I will finish one of these sentences.
No problem.
But Leonard Cohen said the gorgeous thing in his biography, the Sylvia Simmons one, that the world conspires to silence you. So by the time you turn 50, you've either stopped talking or started shouting. And I've decided to start shouting, and I'm not going to not say the things that I really care about anymore. And one of the things that I keep being hit in the face with is that we don't talk about feminism. Women my age don't talk about it to their daughters, and we haven't. I think we've in a new wave now, and I think we've all started talking about it again, but feminism was a word that nobody talked about for 15 or 20 years. And, you know, it's like trying to live a double life, because I wanted to respond in some ways to things that happened, but I didn't want to come across as a snarky old bitchy feminist. And now I think, come across as a snarky old bitchy feminist. Do it.
Yeah, right. It's interesting in the way that comedians work and the things we want to talk about on stage. You strike me as someone, from what I know of your work and your blogs, that you absolutely talk about what you want to. Have you always been that as a comedian? Do you ever feel that when you started out, were you trying to please an audience, or did you start from the point of view of, here's what I want to say?
I think I have some weird idea that people care, would care for a moment about what I think. So that's okay. So I have tried to create turn comedy into a job that paid the mortgage. So to some extent, I've done corporate work from the beginning, which is a crazy thing to do, really. And so it had to be kind of a bit nice and pretty and well behaved, and don't say fuck too much.
But, not too much.
Because I didn't want to go and get another job. I wanted to turn this into a job that made money. So I might have done clean, tidy, socially acceptable comedy in corporate environments, but then I get to a club and I just want to say what I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, did that answer?
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, let's just go back to the beginning then. You were a TV presenter.
Yeah.
Were you a kids' TV presenter?
Yeah.
I'm not. The show is what now? But I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And I came from a theatrical. My mother was an actor when nobody else was, and so being a performer has always been like a perfectly normal job to me.
Sure.
That's what you do. And I was a children's TV presenter, and then I was living in Queenstown after that, between marriages, so many. And everybody else was a singer or musician, and I wanted to be on stage doing stuff too. So I started trying stand up.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what was the first set you ever wrote? Did you write a load of jokes? What were the circumstances of the gig that you did?
I wrote a character piece. About a bridesmaid at a wedding. So, yeah, I started like a lot of women do, with a character piece. So
okay.
That sort of bridge between theatre and stand-up. And then I moved to Auckland, and the very first piece of stand-up I wrote was for a television gig that night. And I wrote it, I think I had a six-month-old baby at that point, and I wrote a piece about how I'd read in the newspaper the day before that the average woman's nipple has 5,472, I'm exaggerating because I can't remember, ducts that release breast milk, and that I wanted to know who had that job. That was a really interesting job to have, to count nipple ducts. That was the sort of 5-minute set that I wrote.
Okay, and where did that come from? Did that come from you say who had that job? Was that just kind of, this is a weird thing, sort of observational comedy?
Well, no, it genuinely seriously occurred to me. Because I'm not looking for gags, but my mind just says, well, fuck, how do they know that? Whose job is it to do that? So I'm not necessarily looking for the gag, it's just that's where my mind immediately goes when I read something like that.
Sure. But you starting out aged... What was that face? What did that say?
Oh, just how mental I am.
So with you starting out, did you have a kind of an argumentative attack as a comedian? Do you see what I mean? Having seen... I mean, my experience of your comedy is that hour that I saw.
Yeah.
And... Is that radically different from the stuff that you were doing then? Did you have an urge to get involved?
Yeah, I think so. I, Yeah. I think it's always what I think comedy is about. And I was 32 when I started doing stand up, so quite grown up, really, quite old. I've done other things, but I think comedy for me is all about letting people know that they're not the only one who thinks what you think. Mm-hmm. For me, it's the I'm going to get really winky.
No, great.
Can you handle that? It's that shared human consciousness. So it's those moments where I'm hoping that weird reaction I had to nipple ducts is something that has occurred to somebody else, or that at the very least, if it hasn't occurred to them, that when they realise that occurred to me, they don't think I'm mental.
Okay.
I reckon that we all know that there's something wrong with us. We're not quite sure what it is. And so we quite like to get inside somebody else's mind and be reassured that we're no more mental than anybody else.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I'm going to release all of these episodes. I'm recording a bunch here. And obviously at the moment, I'm preoccupied with my show. And just for the sake of my listenership, I don't want to bang on about the things I was speaking to Jerry Christmas about earlier this week. But I'm absolutely grappling with that at the moment. Of how do you... It's a risk, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a risk to expose yourself to say, hey, you know when you...
Yeah.
Or even, does anyone else...
Yeah.
Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
And I find that really challenging to expose myself...
Yeah.
...in that kind of way. Do you find it hard or are you happy wearing your heart on your sleeve?
No, but I'm happy wearing my heart on my sleeve. And I think that I don't ever couch it in terms of, hey, have you ever noticed or do you think... I just go, this is what goes on in my head. And if they laugh, it means it goes on in their head or that they find it endearing. And either of those two things is okay because it means I'm not alone. I really do think that the comedy is all about we're not alone. That clapping, I think of clapping as people metaphorically holding hands.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
let the record state that Michelle did a face as she explained that as well, as if to say, God, what am I saying?
I know, I'm being quite honest. That's good, though. Yeah, so no, it is, because when I go and see a comedy show, it's those gasps of recognition where you go, oh, it's not just me who thinks that, or oh, that's an amazing way to look at the world.
And have you had experiences where you've either starting out or more recently in your career, have you had experiences when you've gone on, tried new material,
yeah,
and gone, hey, I do this thing, and you've just been met with incomprehension? Or is it always, have you got a good nose for kind of going, okay, that stuff they'll relate to, that stuff maybe that is private?
Yeah.
Is there a scale, or is everything's out there?
Probably.
That's three questions at once.
Yeah, I'm sure I won't tell them everything. And I can't think of any moments where anybody's gone, you're just mental. There's usually someone who feels the same way about stuff. I can't think of any times where it's had a complete brick wall. I mean, I chuck stuff out there all the time because I also write a weekly column for a newspaper. And that's just, I used to be really frightened of that. And now it's just, I just throw it out there, and it's like, you know, checking to see if pasta's cooked. You just see what sticks to the wall.
Okay.
And I'm gratified that mostly at least one other crazy person will go, yeah, me too. I'm working on a bit at the moment that's going to turn up in a column that I'm going to write on Monday, that I want to be a lapsed woman. You know the way you can be a lapsed Catholic? It's like you can't ever really leave the Catholic Church, but you don't have to go to services anymore or truly believe in
it.
I'd like to be a lapsed woman because I'm just sick of it. I'm sick of having to the getting dressed and the putting the makeup on and the believing the bullshit in the magazines and being defined by my gender, like, you know, like people are defined by being Catholic. So I'd like to be a lapsed woman and not tick any box on the gender thing. So I'm sure there's some jokes in there eventually, but I've not there yet clearly, but I said to a girlfriend last night, I'm working on a piece for my column about being a lapsed woman, and she immediately, her eyes lit up and she went, oh, that's a great idea, you mean like Catholic, so you just don't have to do the ritual
anymore. Right.
Yeah, so there's something there, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm in ideas mode, not audience mode. So
yeah,
don't take me not laughing as problematic. No, I think that's great. Of course, that works as a premise. Brilliant.
Yeah, so already I'm okay with that because I've met one woman who understands what you're talking about.
Yes.
That'll do. You know, that's good. Yes. So Ruth says that that makes sense to her. So if the rest of the world go, it doesn't matter.
Okay. Do you have, I'm coming back to something we briefly mentioned earlier. Do you have stuff that isn't available to an audience? Are there things you think that you don't say?
Yeah, but that might change. I mean, I think I've probably tucked some ways that I think and the ways I view the world away. There are certainly bits of my life that I will never talk about. I always, for a period of time after my second divorce, I did a lot of jokes and became quite well known for doing a lot of jokes about the ex-husband. And people would criticise me for... When I say people, I mean men, would criticise me for having a crack at him because he's not there, right? So that's like a powerful position to talk about somebody who's not in the room. And people would criticise it, and again, I mean men, for being too personal. And it kind of amused me because I have never talked about the specifics of why that marriage ended because they're...
Sure.
You know, it was sort of horrific. I like the way I put sort of into that.
Sort of horrific,
sort of
yeah,
horrific.
Okay.
And so, and none of the stuff that I talked about was specific or particular to my experience. I picked the stuff that I thought would be universal enough for other people in the room who have been through a breakup to understand. So that kind of answers your question about whether there are some things that I don't.
Sure. And do you think that response from critics, by which I mean men,
do you
think that response was because even though the stuff wasn't specific, it was relatable enough that they felt personally aggrieved?
Yeah.
They felt like you were having a go at either men or them specifically.
Yeah.
And how does that make you feel to think that you're... I mean, presumably that's a sign of success as a comic, that you're going, yep, bang, got it, nailed it, if people are reacting
that way. I guess so. And then, there's a little tiny piece of me that feels a bit smug that I managed to get away with it. Oh, does that make sense? That I managed to exorcise the pain of that situation through comedy without... really revealing too much.
Okay.
Because I think if you go through major life events, like, you know, marriage, divorce, falling in love, falling out of love, birth, death, you have to talk about them as a comedian or, you know, you're not authentic. You can't... You have to talk about the thing that's making the noise in the head. So I had to talk about that stuff, but I didn't tell anybody else's story. You know, I didn't tell any of my daughter's story in a real way, and I didn't tell his story in a real way, and I didn't reveal too much of my real stuff. Yeah.
And when you talk about the noise in the head, that's a I've not heard anyone use that expression before. I really like that. I can't do anything but talk about the stuff I end up talking about. The last three shows I've made have all been about various deficiencies in my life that I've ended up somehow, you know, either engaging with because of the comedy process or what have you. And for this one, the fourth show, I thought, right, it's just jokes. Just going to do jokes. A couple of months into it, it's not just jokes. It's absolutely... No. I can't help but talk about the stuff.
Yeah. It will make you... And, you know, it's like trying to have a quiet evening with a small child in the corner shouting, "No, me! Yeah. Talk about me!" Yeah, you have to deal with it. And also, I always think if you don't talk about the thing that's making the noise in your head, then everything else will stop making a noise and you won't have any ideas. I'm sure that's where writer's block comes from.
That's interesting, because you're actually avoiding the thing that needs...
Yeah.
Okay.
So all the other ideas, the smaller, quieter ideas, are going to sit there with your arms folded going, "Nah, not coming. You deal with that and then we'll come."
Yeah. Oh, that would be lovely. It would be lovely to think that writer's block was a real thing, that which I'm sure it is, but it's real and it has a real cause, and that might be a solution. That's actually fascinating. Yeah. I remember reading a blog, I don't know, a couple of years ago, about someone who said that I found the cure for writer's block. So I looked at it. They said, what you need to do is find, I think the example they had was a car engine that they had taken apart and needed to put back together, didn't know what the hell they were doing. So as soon as you've got something you want to do, even less than writing, suddenly you can use the writing itself as a displacement activity.
Yeah, okay, that would work.
Do you find it difficult to write? It seems from the volume of your output that you chuck stuff out.
It's
there. Do you ever?
Favorite thing.
Okay.
I love it. I love
more
it.
More so than the performing. Which side? If you could only do one.
Ooh. If I could only do one, I think I'd just write. But I love the performing thing.
Sure. Which of your children would you say?
And often I think of writing as the practical hard part. I mean, it's like getting ready for a party, and then getting on stage is throwing the party. So there's no point in getting ready for a party all the time if you don't get to throw the party.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. And do you have, talking about the writing, let's look at specifically the writing of stand-up rather than the blog for now.
Yep.
Do you have a structure? Do you have a kind of a plan to what you do in the week? Is it just when it grabs you or when you grab it?
Yeah, it's when it grabs me, and I'm always a little bit disappointed in myself that I don't have a plan and a structure. I think maybe I would produce more new material that way. But I like to wait for it to just land in my head from the gods. I like it to just drop in. And, you know, even if that's only a bit of it, and then you build around it. But I do kind of wait for it to arrive like a gift.
And what's your kind of regular output? Are you writing a new show a year, every 2 or 3 years? Or what's your...
The one that I did last year, The Stuff I Forgot to Tell My Daughter show, was my first solo show in 7 years.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I'd been busy with, raising the kid and earning the living. And I really think festival shows should be the thing that you do because you can't bear not to do them. And I hadn't got to that point for 7 years. Mm. I did, prior to that, I was doing one every year. And then I just went, why? I'm doing this because I feel like I need to write a festival show. Why don't I wait until I have a show I can't bear not to do?
Yeah.
And so that's what I did with that one.
Michelle's great. I'm sure you're enjoying this as much as I am. We're about to get stuck into some properly deep, fascinating territory. That's all coming right up. And well done for listening to this one as well. If you're not familiar with Michelle's work, she's a big noise in New Zealand, doesn't have too big a profile in the UK. And I know some of you, I'm talking to the UK listeners now, some of you only download the EPs with people that you've already heard of. I hope you trust me enough by now that you know I only have people on the show if I think they're superb and if I'm convinced that you'll agree. So I'm not going to say any more about that just now. In the second half of this interview, we do get stuck into some fairly weighty topics. So if you're listening in the UK, think of this as a little reward for taking a chance on someone you might not be so familiar with. A couple of little adverts again. Sorry, global listeners. I can only advertise stuff I'm doing, and most of my work at the moment is in the UK. A couple of previews coming up. The 8th of June, I'm in Southend with James Acaster doing a doubleheader preview at the Joker Comedy Club. You can Google up some information on that, the Joker in Southend. That's the 8th of June. On the 10th of June, a preview with John Hastings at the Harrison in Euston. The 18th of June, I'm doing a preview at the Pleasance in London on my own. Be great to see you there. And the 6th of July, the brilliant ARG Festival. Do look online at argcomfest.com. So argcomfest.com. That's at the Garage in Highbury, also in London. Thank you once again for all of your donations. Just hit the PayPal button at comedianscomedian.com if you'd like to join your fellow frog killers in supporting this show with whatever size donation you deem appropriate. A pound a show makes you a better comedian. That's official. And we're going to get that peer-reviewed just as soon as we get around to it. That's all for now. I'm going to get stuck straight back into this one because I think we've got a lot more to say. Let's get back to Michelle Acorn.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You mentioned earlier on the idea of authenticity, and that's clearly important to you. You know, yeah. You're a person that speaks your mind and wants to engage. You know, it's not just kind of, you know, whimsical stuff.
Yeah.
When you see other comics who are on that track of banging out a show every year, what's your opinion of that? Do you think that they're dredging everything up and saying stuff they don't need to say, or is it just that they're going through so much shit they have to say a new thing?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I tend not to go to see somebody's show unless I think that they really, really cared about it. Yeah, and you know, you kind of know who the people are who have, even if there's just some kind of thematic device that holds it together. That narrative's really important to me. I like stories that take me places and end up somewhere. So if I think it's just going to be chunks of bits of pieces
TV,
of shit,
TV friendly 10-minute slots.
Yeah, yeah, I don't go. But if it's somebody's got a concept that makes me go, wow, that I want to know what that's like, then I'll go to it. So. And I do sometimes sit. Sometimes you sit watching people, and you just think, I don't fucking believe you. And I hate that. I hate seeing a comedian doing stuff that I don't believe.
Do you mean that they've made up an event, or do you mean they don't believe them?
Or they don't believe even the idea behind it, I know it's not comedy's not a documentary, but sometimes it just feels like lying.
Certainly, I can certainly think of shows I've seen where I've come away with the inescapable feeling that someone has contrived a position.
Yeah. And I'll fold my arms, literally fold my arms, and inside my head I'm going, bullshit, I don't believe you. Mm. And it takes all the joy of it, even of a really well-constructed gag. If I don't really believe that this thing that you're saying is true, then I'm not, and I won't enjoy it.
You're someone that started. I was talking to Jared earlier this week, and he was saying that you were right in at the beginning of the classic.
Yeah, right at the beginning of
the sort of the scene, really, the circuit in New Zealand.
I was the scene started in 79, and I turned up in 89. That's how young it is here, and I turned up in 90. The end of 93. No, end of 92. Yeah, so almost at the beginning. So, yeah, when it was a monthly gig in a pub called Kitty O'Brien's, and then it was a weekly gig, and then we opened the classic.
So you were part of the team that, when you said we opened the classic, so
it was a team of people a bunch of comedians who threw some money into a pot, but I wanted to throw money into the pot and was too late for that to be a cash investor in it. As it turned out, they all lost their money, so probably I did a good thing.
Sure.
But then Scott bought the club and carried it on, so it's been going ever since.
Okay. Yeah. And something I'm always, whenever I talk to a New Zealand comic, I'm always banging on about how supportive and nourishing I find the circuit here. Yeah. Do you agree that's the case? Has it always been like that?
Yeah, I think so, because it was so small and so new and so young. There was a sort of, I got together with a bunch of other people in 1999 and started the New Zealand Comedy Guild. And I was I looked after that for 7 years and don't now, because it's, you know, other people's turn to do that stuff. But there was a lot of talking behind hands, people going, this is a bit shit, we don't get paid enough money, and somebody else is undercutting prices on corporate events and blah blah blah. So we started the guild so that we could on a regular basis get together and talk to each other about how much money people were earning, or if you went and did a gig at a pub and they didn't earn enough money and weren't going to pay you, you had suddenly a letter from the guild on guild letterhead saying you will be forthwith and stuff like that worked. Mostly it was about us talking to each other. I mean, we used to not get paid for being in the gala on television.
What? Okay.
Yeah, so that's one of the first things that the guild did. Because the argument from the television people was that this was the most amazing advertisement for you that you could possibly ever hope to have. So why would you want to get paid for that?
Yeah, right.
And so we dug our toes in and said, well, if you don't pay us, you pay your camera operators and your soundies and your director. If you don't pay us, we won't turn up.
I can't believe you managed to make that work with comics. Is that presumably because of the size of the industry at that time was enough that you... I mean, could you get all the comics in a room?
Yeah, you could. You could. Right. All 12 of us, said.
Is that a guild? Is that a minibus? I think that's been tried in the UK with no success. Yeah. There isn't, you know...
I think it was also... You're right. It was size and time and history. And also there were no producers, managers, agents... for comedians, and I think although that ultimately is a bad thing, it was a really good thing for a guild, because there's no, you don't have a manager or an agent getting in there and going, hey, whoa, you're allowed to charge whatever you want for a corporate event. There shouldn't be a sort of standard or a minimum pay rate or whatever.
That does sound really healthy, and I'm always struck by how, have you had any part of the, you know, I know they do class comedy here, they're a kind of,
I didn't do class. I didn't get involved in class with comedians because I don't believe you can teach it. But I'm wrong. So
no, that's okay. But this is a platform for you. So you don't think you can teach comedy?
No.
Can you help someone get better at comedy?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I think you can teach. You can teach skills.
I recognise this is a divisive issue, so you know what I mean? It's fine for you to have come on your side of it. That's it.
Yeah, no, I think it's bullshit, but bless. And I'm totally wrong, because the people that come out of Class Comedians are really good, and they come with some skills that other people don't have. They're already ahead of the game because they've been through that program. But I just think it's bullshit to sit in a room and talk to people about how to be funny. I reckon you do it on stage, right? You can show somebody how to hold a microphone at the right angle and how you make a mic stand go up and down. And after that, it's just getting on stage and doing gigs. But having said that, I also understand that I'm totally wrong.
It's really weird. I'm very conflicted about it. I've taught some stand-up classes to students, and, like, you know, 18, 19-year-old students. And I don't feel like I've done the wrong thing by doing it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm so cagey about trying to give any advice or anything. Because I think comedy is about being different to everyone else.
Yeah.
So how can you tell people how to be more like themselves? I'm sure it's possible somehow. I don't know who can do it, and I only ever feel like I'm kind of fudging my way towards it. This is, you know, this is the blind leading the blind.
Yeah, see, two things for me is I did do some workshops years ago showing people how to do comedy, and I felt like such a dick. It just felt wrong and bad. And the other thing is, when I hear the kind of advice that other people give to comedians, just be like yourself, but more. Or you just need to be authentic, and maybe you need to wear different pants. And I just want to stab everybody in the eye.
Have you ever been given advice by another comic that you actually thought was useful, was worthwhile advice?
No. On individual gags, on material, yeah. But I think advice from other comics about how to be or what kind of comedian you should be is appalling. You know, but I had terrible experiences in the early days of being told by people who ran comedy gigs what I needed to do. Basically, I needed to be younger, prettier, and cuter.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was, I mean, nobody said, I reckon you should do more social commentary, Michelle.
No, right.
They said, it's a shame that, you know, there's another girl who's prettier and younger than you, and she wears more interesting clothes, so you're pretty screwed, really.
And how did you react to that at the time?
By just working really hard and mentally punching people in the face and fighting back. The guy that said that to me, poor dude, he's an accountant now. So I feel like I won that one.
Maybe if it was younger, he'd have another shot.
Yeah. He just needed a better suit.
So in those, in terms of like people giving you advice on gags or your own writing on gags. When you're writing routines, and are you writing at the moment towards another show? Are you?
No, I've just signed a contract to turn stuff I forgot to tell my daughter into a book.
Of course you have. Yeah. Yes, you mentioned this.
So that's kind of my writing taken up for the next few months.
Now, my instinct, probably totally wrong, my sort of privileged, self-involved instinct would be that stand-up is the hardest thing to write.
Yeah.
And once you've, I think I was saying this in conversation earlier on today, once you've felt that pressure of every sentence needs to get a big laugh, surely...
Yeah.
Any other writing is easier. Now, maybe there'll be people listening to this that write obituaries who go, oh, that's my specialist thing is the hardest. I don't know. But do you find that in terms of a few drafts of the book? Are you thinking this is a whole different story?
I feel really relaxed about writing the book. And, you know, ask me again in about 6 weeks.
Yeah, so right, okay.
I might tell you something else. But I think you're absolutely right that writing for the eye in a book is so much less pressured than writing for the ear in a club. And so I'm excited about being able to say stuff that's not funny but amusing. And also going off in directions that I can go off in that you can't really do in a show. Every time when I was doing that show that you saw in Christchurch that had, as well as it having five endings, which I have to work out sometime.
Not endings.
Yep. Is that I'd get to a bit and want to talk about something else. Well, writing a book, I can, because I just put another chapter in and then come back. So I'm really excited. I love words. I love that. That's my... I'm so happy sitting in my office, which is the most beautiful space in the whole world.
Which of your jokes would you say that you are most proud of? Do you have a joke that you think, nailed that one? Do you have a joke or a bit that you think, you know, maybe like a signature bit or maybe just a moment, a turn of phrase or something? Because I have that feeling of like, oh, I've minted a thing there. That's what really attracted me to it. I find it very difficult to write. It sounds idyllic to me, this situation. I find it bloody difficult performing as well. But, you know, somehow between it all comes good eventually. But I do sometimes think, well, listen, there's that line, there's that joke.
Yeah.
And I wrote that. I'm definitely a comedian because I wrote that.
Oh, okay. There are some. I'm hopeless at trying to get my brain to come up with them when I'm with whatever it is, or any of my comedy, when I'm not in my comedy brain.
Yeah.
But there are bits that I really enjoy doing at the moment. There's a bit that
And you don't need to prove. You don't need to tell us what it is, and you know there'd be some weight of expectation that it kill this podcast.
Yeah. But you're right that there are bits when you've written a gag where you go, oh look at me, I did what a comedian does.
Yeah.
And that's really gratifying. And it took me years before I used to say that I did stand up comedy, and it took me years to say I am a comedian. And there's a huge difference inside my head.
I think I know what you mean, but just tell us a bit more. Just illustrate the difference between those two.
Because I wasn't convinced that I was a comedian. I knew that I did comedy, and I appeared in comedy shows, and I made people laugh, and I was performing. I was doing the job of, but I wasn't necessarily a comedian as a human being. Does that make it any clearer?
What are the differences in you? What are the differences between a comedian and a person that does comedy?
Oh, any wanker can do comedy.
That's the answer. There we go.
Yeah. But a comedian has like a little twist in their DNA, and they've done the hard yards, and they've, you know, proven themselves to some degree, or have an oeuvre, have something to fall back on. You know, yeah. Yeah, I mean, any fuckwit can get up and do 5 minutes and be hilarious. And most people are hilarious the first time they get up and do 5 minutes. It's your 500th gig. That's the one. That's the one that says that you're a comedian.
Yeah. And did you, when you were starting out and developing into what you are now, when you were writing jokes then, were you sitting down and writing on a laptop?
Yeah, I tried that. I would try that. This is before laptops. I did it on a slate. It was before I had a computer, for sure. I've still got, you know, those notebooks, school notebooks with terrible stuff in
it. Do you ever look back through them? I've got loads of notebooks, and I at the time I thought, I'll keep all these and I'll look back through them. I've never gone back to them.
Are they? Yeah, because you look at them and go, oh, who was I? Who was this douche? So I would try and create comedy, but I even got a book called Comedy Writing Step by Step.
I believe I have that book.
Yeah, and I tried to do the exercises in it.
Is that the Jean Parade book?
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I tried to do the exercises in there, and I wrote terrible shit. It was awful. So, I still do that thing of waiting for the magic idea to arrive in my head. It quite often happens sitting watching television watching the news, with, you know, anything that sparks my anger or bewilderment, particularly sitting next to Jeremy, my husband, and I'll say something, and he'll say something, and I'll say something, and suddenly there's a real thing that might be worth taking on stage, turning up, and one of us will grab dibs, and off you go.
For the benefit of the listener, Jeremy is Jeremy Elwood, the brilliant New Zealand comedian. So you do have to, you've got to call stuff.
Yeah.
I actually saw Sarah Pascoe and John Robbins doing this backstage last night at a gig where she was going, I said that, and he said, no, you said that, but what I said was took that into a new direction, and you are both right.
Yeah,
please resolve this between yourselves.
And you know, the best thing you can do for your relationship is when you see your partner on stage doing the gag that you think that you wrote and hear the laughter, be pleased for them.
You have to
be generous enough to take that away as actually that's a little laugh for me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, well, there's no finer time in a comedian's life when someone great is doing brilliantly and then does a tag that you suggested. And you look around for someone next to you just so you can just dive bomb. Anyone, that was me.
Yeah. I've been guilty of leaning across to people I don't even know and saying, I wrote that.
Ah, amazing.
Terrible. You can't do that. Yeah.
Your persona on stage is you.
Yeah.
There's no change. There's no kind of, did you ever try to find your voice? Was that ever a thing? Do you recognise what that means?
Yeah, I do. And I think because I came from doing, I did character stuff. I even did stuff at Kitty O'Brien's, the club where the stand-up used to happen. I did it in a wig. That's how it all...
out of a sense of what? What motivated that?
Because I just need hiding behind a character. Yeah, not convinced that anything I had to say was very interesting or that anybody would want to hear it. So I would create a wacky character or something.
That seems so far removed from who you are now. Was it the hard yards that did that to you? Yeah. Was it one? And I'm using that phrase forever, by the way. I'm loving that. Or was there one particular thing? Was there a turning point that you went, actually, screw this?
Yeah, there was. You know, this is the great gift that the trauma of a terrible marriage gave to me. Was one? I literally remember this happening. I was doing a gig up north in a quite a rough pub, in a puppet bar in quite a rough pub, you know, where they were still playing pool when you got on stage and shit. So, and I lost in that night all of my a huge amount of insecurity about whether I had any right to be there, because I gave, for some reason out of nowhere, gave myself a little lecture about, you've been through this and this and this, and you've dealt with this, and you have lived through you've seen more of the world than a bunch of these people in this room, and you have every right to stand on stage and say whatever you fucking think. And that was a night that it happened.
And what was the resulting gig like?
Pretty good. I mean, not amazing. I'd love to say, it was the most amazing game.
In the movie of your life.
Yeah.
The script editor is really going to go to town on this. But
But I think incrementally from then on, I got more and more confident about being on stage. And now I've got to that point, like I said before, where I just don't give a shit. This is me. I do give a shit. But this is me, and this is who I am. You know, I'm asking for 20 minutes or an hour of your life, and if you didn't like it, then it'll be fine. But if this resonates with you and makes you feel like you belong in the world and that there are people in the world who think the way that you do, then, or I've made you think about something in a slightly different way, then fantastic.
I'm going to challenge you on a bit of material now.
Yep.
But I'm doing it. Oh, good. There we go. So that is classic Michelle Acord there. Yeah, bring it on.
All right.
You seem unapologetic about everything that you do on stage and about your life and what you relate to,
yep.
Which bits of it you relate to us. I watched a couple of clips of yours online and I know that they were both the same material. There's a particular bit of material that I was quite surprised by and I don't know if it fitted into something else. On both occasions, you talked down about your face and the fact you're wearing makeup. You said something like, I've slapped a lot on, this is as good as it gets.
Yeah.
That seemed totally out of character for someone as brash and, not brash, but yeah. Someone as confident and unapologetic as you. And I just wondered, because I saw it in two different videos, I just wondered where that came from, whether you felt that you needed to apologise for your face or your femininity or what that was.
I think that's a really good question. It's such a thing for the ladies, and it's a bonding thing with that bit that I do about being middle-aged and you know, looking in the mirror when you get out of the shower before you go to a gig and thinking, fuck, this will be a project. You've got to tidy that shit up so that you don't frighten people. Is a bonding thing with the audience. But it's also, I'm wondering, I think it's not inauthentic for me because I do look at my face and go, I genuinely do look at my face and go, it's not as good as it was yesterday, but it's better than it will be tomorrow. Do you know what I mean? For women, it just, maybe you don't know what I mean, but you don't have to. But women are always second-guessing themselves physically. But I kind of like that chunk of material I do because it says, yeah, I might have some insecurities about how I look, but fuck the insecurities.
Sure.
It's like celebrating the insecurities.
Okay. You're narrowing your eyes there as if you haven't quite covered that.
I'm still thinking that through. That's a really good question to ask me. I have real issues. Oh, look. I have real issues with the aging process for women and how the world perceives you and what that does to how much money I can earn, how much work I can get.
Okay.
Like, I get less and less television work and more radio work.
Right.
Because I don't fit the demographic that people want to put on the small screen. So I have an issue with it.
And is that something, like I've heard some of that material about, you know, putting, slapping this on and it's all going to fall apart later on.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to me to contain the anger that you've just notified there.
Yeah. Yeah, there has been for years a real feeling for me of skipping through some of that stuff and not confronting it. I get terrified of confronting how I get treated by people in the television industry here because I think if I confront them, I'll get even less work as a nun than I do. And I need that work, right, not just to make a living but to maintain a profile. So there's been a lot of how much can I say without losing every opportunity I could ever have?
And does that dynamic exist in your head, or is that a thing you're using to scare yourself out of saying it, or is that based on factual? Do you know anyone that has rocked the boat and then been blacklisted?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You do?
Oh, absolutely. There are people who just don't turn up on TV anymore because they got a bit too fucking lippy, bit mouthy, and I think it happens to women more than it happens to men. Yeah, I really do. So I think that material that you're talking about has turned up because of that anger, but I've presented it in a less than angry way, because there's still bits of me that are try not to offend people, especially the people that can give me a job.
Sure. Is any part of it, do you think, insecurity?
oh, fuck, not really.
No, I wondered, I tell you, I'll be honest, the first thing when I thought that, I thought, oh, I wonder if she's sort of saying that so as to adjust her status with the women in the room.
Yeah, maybe. It's definitely bonding.
Is that what you mean when you said bonding? Yeah. Okay. Because I don't know if you've experienced that before. I've talked to other female comedians who say that one of the unique elements, let's say, of being a female comedian is that if you're a bloke, men laugh at you, women laugh at you.
Yeah.
If you're a woman, there's a possibility that men laugh at you and their wives don't like that they're laughing at you, and they judge you differently. They're like, who does she think she is?
I think that's true, but I think because I used to be a children's TV presenter in this country, that's not a problem. I don't think I think they see me as the woman who used to entertain them on Saturday mornings.
Gotcha.
I think, yeah. I don't know exactly what you're talking about, but I don't think that applies to me. Yeah, I don't know.
So that's nearly all from Michelle. But before we finish, I'd like to include a conversation we had about a show we both happened to see a few days previously. Now, I'm not in the habit of critiquing other comics' work, especially in these interviews. That's not what this podcast is about. But in this particular case, I thought Michelle's opinion would be of particular interest. We've both seen Reginald D. Hunter's New Zealand debut. He's an excellent comic. I'm sure many of you all know Reg. A really terrific comic who doesn't shy away from some very difficult territory. We've not had Reg on the show yet. I hope we'll get him on before too long. And I hope he won't mind us analysing his work in the context of this wider conversation about the responsibility of the artist. So we'll just bob back in now to get Michelle Acourt's thoughts on that show that we both saw.
I'm really glad I saw it, and I've been thinking about it a lot for a week. What really, really struck me... Can I explain that? I need to say the line that made me think I couldn't breathe. And if I had been able to walk out at that point without anybody seeing that I'd walked out, I would have walked out. Not because I wanted to storm out, but because I just didn't want to be there. Reg, everybody probably knows the joke. He does the joke about, he tells the story about his friend who has been raped and she doesn't tell the police and she deals with the healing in her own way. So the story that his friend has is a story that a lot of women have. And so then to dismiss it as just a story / fiction and say that if your response isn't to call the police, then it's not real, and that most of all the phrase tell it later to get what you want is just extraordinary. And so women use those experiences to emotionally blackmail men who haven't done the crime. God, it's really hard to be fucking articulate about this because I find it was such an emotional reaction.
Let's look at this from a comic perspective,
yep.
From a professional comedian perspective.
Yeah.
Because I can see you're upset.
Yeah.
I think what I want to do is talk about the wider issue of this. Because I don't, you know, I've not had Reg on the show. I know him. I like him.
I really like him.
Absolutely.
I've known him for years. He's a good dude.
Yeah.
You know, he's a really good man who thinks really deeply and who wants to affect social change. One of the things that occurs to me is that maybe he... And this is a terribly pejorative, judgmental thing. Maybe he shouldn't be telling women what they should do if they're raped. Maybe he should be talking to men who rape, or talking to men about men who rape, or talking to all of us. You know, because all of his stuff was about what women do and what women think and how women behave. And I wonder, it's made me think that maybe what comedians need to do is talk to their own tribe. One of the things that somebody said to me about my show, the Stuff I Forgot show, was that it doesn't talk about men, it talks about women. And I'm really pleased with that. It talks about feminism in terms of women, not in terms of men. And maybe that's important. that you're talking to the people that you are one of?
I think what a lot of people find problematic about issues-based stand-up comedy is that we're all of us comics think of ourselves as individual entertainers or artists or speakers of truth.
Yeah.
And I think that it's so hard to say to someone, why don't you do this instead of what you're doing?
Oh, it's a terrible thing to say. You know, I wouldn't ever sit down with Reg and say, no, I don't think you should talk about them, Reg. I think you should talk. But I'm meaning in the bigger picture, if you come at it from the idea that you want to make a difference, then maybe you need to think about how you approach that.
Do you think that comedians have a right to say anything that they like? Do you think there are any limits on the free speech of a comedian?
No, absolutely not. I think that's what stand-up comedy is free speech. And so people have the freedom to say whatever they want, and I have the freedom to shout back and or not go to their show and tell other people to not go to their show or any of those things. I think that's the magic of stand-up comedy is anybody can say anything. And even if it's hateful and triggering and all of those things, but we're all allowed to shout back, right? We can all shout back at them. That's really important. But as soon as you start censoring yourself and saying, oh, I can't ever talk about rape or race, or then it's like, you know, the ideas won't come. If you don't talk about the one that's making the noise, then the other ones aren't going to come either. Really early on, I wrote a rape sketch, a comedy sketch about rape. And so that's always been my reason for saying nothing's off the table. It's all on the table. It's how you tell the joke. And it has to be really fucking funny.
And we both know. I mean, we know that Reg was running in material, I believe.
He
sort of, you know, he was exploring some ideas. And there has to be a forum for if you're going to end up with something brilliantly structured and tightly written and scripted and all the rest of it, there has to be a process on the way there.
Yeah, totally.
That's very tricky.
It's really tricky. I mean, I would love to sit down with him and talk to him about it, but I think everybody's been throwing things at Reg for a while for stuff, and, you know, maybe that's not the greatest of ideas. I really admire what he's doing. And I'm so pleased I saw that show. And there were some things in there that made me think really hard. And there was a lot of stuff that made me laugh as well. Made me laugh heaps. But, yeah. Don't know why I put a but in there. I mean, I want that from a comedy show, right? That show has been playing in my head for a week. That's a great thing to get out of a show. And I don't want to punch him in the face. I would love to have a conversation with him. I'd like to tell him why that gag was so difficult.
It's hard, isn't it, to talk about? What word do you use? You know, that gag was so problematic, challenging. What, you know,
it was traumatic for me.
Yes.
It brought stuff up. And he doesn't know that. And it's not his job to even fucking know that. He doesn't need to know that. You know, it shouldn't affect the way he does his show, but maybe there's a conversation to be had over a bottle of wine.
I'd like to, well, we've got to wrap up now because no, absolutely. This has been fascinating. I've really appreciated you coming on the show. I've got certain stock questions that I like to ask, and a new one that has occurred to me recently, which maybe you won't get on board with in terms of your feelings on teaching and, you know, so forth. But something I asked Ben Hurley recently was, if you were to get hit by a bus tomorrow, what do you want your legacy to be comedy-wise? You know, if there are certain principles that you were like, do you know what? On my comedy gravestone, it says, here's the rule. Here's my one or two principles. This is what comedy's all about for me. And, you know, almost like a mission statement.
Yeah.
Do you have... What is it for you? It's a huge question.
It's a huge question. I reckon somebody wants to know. That I think that it's really important to me to bear in mind that whatever crazy idea I have, somebody wants to know and somebody else thinks the same thing. So say it out loud.
Thank you. That's brilliant.
So that was Michelle. Some really excellent stuff there, especially on her concerns about people's view of older women, producers and so forth, and the way they see older women in the industry rocking the boat and so on. I suppose I'd naively hoped that comedy was immune to that sort of bullshit. I suppose we've seen with Sarah Millican's BAFTA dress letter, a very passionate and exciting letter that Sarah wrote in defence of wearing whatever the fuck she wants to the BAFTAs. We've seen that is still, you know, people still bother to comment on stuff like that, even when we, I suppose, I feel as comedians, we should be sacrosanct. Anyway, that's a story for another time. But that was Michelle. I urge you to check out her stuff if you get the chance. Next week, it's the turn of the brilliant Jared Christmas. Can't wait for... Oh, no, is it Jared next week? Or am I going to hold him back for a week because I want to put a new little... I've got a little exciting advertising thing coming up. I say exciting. Exciting to me. To you, it's going to be, I'm sure, 25 seconds that you're going to have to look out the window for. I'm going to experiment with working with an advert, and you'll have to tell me what you think of it. So I think next week, either it's next week, I'm wool gathering now, I'm sorry, it's Tuesday morning, so it's effectively Monday morning after that bank holiday. But coming up soon, let's say, coming up soon, Jared Christmas, and also coming up soon, an amazingly dry as sand, Australian comedian called Luke Heggie. So I don't know which order we'll do those in, but both of them, great stuff. Should have mentioned last week, when I did the blurb for audible.co.uk/cc, not / Stuart, audible.co.uk/cc, Tom Rigglesworth himself from last week's episode has got his series of open letters that he referred to in the show. Rigglesworth's open letters are available to download on Audible. And of course, if you don't have an Audible account, you can get a free trial. But if you go via audible.co.uk/cc, then the show gets a little donate-y type gift from Audible for pointing you in their direction. So please do that. That's all for now. Luke Heggie or Jared Christmas coming up next week. Both of them great interviews, great comics. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. This show was produced by Nathan Wood. I'll speak to you next week.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.